Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Last week, my guest was Congressman John Katko, who represents New York's 24th Congressional District. This week, I'm joined by his Democratic opponent, Dana Balter. In 2018, Ms. Balter lost a close election to Congressman Katko. She was last on the program in May during the Democratic primary, and you can find that interview on WRVO.org, along with my recent conversations with Congressman Katko. The 24th District includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties, and the western portion of Oswego County. Dana, thanks for making the time for this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Grant. It's always fun talking to you.
Well, I know you're extremely busy right now, so let's get right into it. Here's my understanding of the main theme of your campaign. It seems to me to be similar to what it was in 2018, and that is that Congressman Katko is both more conservative and more aligned with President Trump than he claims he is. So I wanted to start by asking you, let's look specifically at the last 2 years. And what are the most important instances of either his behavior or his voting that you're looking at to make that argument?
So I would say, first of all, that yes, that's true. It is also true that he is continually casting votes that aren't in the interest of Central and Western New Yorkers, and that's a really important part of our argument as well. And that is irrespective of Donald Trump. But yes, if we look at what's happened over the last few years, he has repeatedly sided with Donald Trump, with his party leadership, and with his corporate donors in ways that are harmful for Central and Western New Yorkers. The 2017 tax bill is a perfect example. That vote was cast in 2017, but we've seen the effects of it in the last year and almost 2 years now, as people have filed their taxes under that law. And I've heard from voters all across the district who have seen their taxes go up, in some cases by thousands of dollars. Members of labor unions who have seen their taxes go up because they lost the deductibility of their union dues and work expenses. We know now, it's not speculative, but we know based on evidence that the vast majority of the benefits of that bill went to the wealthiest people in this country and corporations, not everyday folks. John Katko has repeatedly voted against equal pay for women. That is a vote that has come up just in the last couple of years. He re-emphasized, re-announced his opposition to universal background checks for gun purchases, which is a common sense measure that makes our communities safer, that more than 90% of Americans support. John Katko, who is funded by the NRA and the gun lobby, opposes that very common sense policy. We have example after example after example. And perhaps the most telling is that he endorsed Donald Trump for re-election for 2020. That is something he did just a few months ago. And he said in that endorsement that our country is better off now than it was 3 years ago. I am not sure what he's looking at to make that assessment, but nobody that I know, including thousands of Republicans and independent voters across this district, believes that our country is in better shape now than it was. Donald Trump has botched the response to this pandemic in ways that have cost tens of thousands of lives that did not need to be lost. He has made the economic response far more devastating than it needed to be. He is constantly fomenting hatred and fear and bigotry and division in this country. And John Katko has endorsed him, telling us that he supports his leadership for the next 4 years. That alone is an indication that he's out of touch with Central and Western New Yorkers.
Okay, I want to dig into some of the issues that you just mentioned there as we have this conversation. But let me stick on this just for a minute, and then we'll move on to that. So taking what you've just said there, I want to understand how you would square that then with the fact that several independent research organizations have found Congressman Katko to be one of the most bipartisan members of Congress and one of the most moderate Republicans in Congress. So make sense of that for me.
Okay, so I think I'm only aware of one organization that has given him this rating. And what that rating of bipartisanship is based on is whether or not you co-sponsor bills with members of the opposite party. And John Katko does that. And that's important. I don't dismiss that. By the way, I will do that too. I think any good member of Congress does that. But that alone is not a measure of whether or not he is on the side of the people. That alone is not a measure of whether or not he supports a president who is dangerous to us. Those two things can coexist simultaneously, and I'm happy that he co-sponsors bills with Democrats. But what I need him to do, and what Central and Western New Yorkers need him to do, is to stand up when it matters most, when his no vote would count the most. I need him, our voters need him, to stand up and support tax policy and economic policy that helps everyday working families. We need him to stand up and say, Donald Trump is currently engaged in an assault on our democracy by trying to undermine the Postal Service and undermine our election. And that's anti-democratic. That's what dictators do. That's not okay. John Katko is unwilling time after time after time to stand up against Donald Trump's worst instincts and most dangerous assaults on our democracy. That's what I'm talking about here. And people across Central and Western New York know that that's true. I hear from them every day, people who tell me, I voted for John Katko in 2014. I voted for him in 2016. And I'm sorry to tell you, I voted for him in 2018, but I'm not voting for him again because Donald Trump is dangerous and John Katko supports him.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Democratic congressional candidate Dana Balter. Well, I do want to get into some of those issues you mentioned, and I want to spend some time on what you're for and what kinds of policy initiatives you'd be advocating for if you were elected. And I'd like to ask you several different policy questions, and if you could be brief, it would allow me to cover a lot of ground for our listeners. So I'd ask you just to be brief here. Let me start with the first one.
I will try my best.
I'll try to help you. You've publicly expressed excitement over Kamala Harris as the vice presidential nominee for the Democrats. And recently, she put forward with Senator Bernie Sanders a proposal to dramatically enhance the stimulus payments. Under her proposal, anyone earning up to $100,000 per year would receive $2,000 per month, phased out at $120,000 of income, plus $2,000 for each dependent. It would be retroactive to last March. It would cover every U.S. resident, and these payments would last until 3 months after the end of the pandemic. So I guess to try to get a sense of your positioning, is that something you would support?
Well, before I could know, I could tell you whether I'd support that specific bill, I'd need to read analysis of it, which I haven't yet. So I don't know if those numbers that you just cited are the numbers that I think are the right numbers. What I can tell you is that I support the idea of it.
I took that off of Forbes magazine.
Yeah. So I just don't know. I haven't read an analysis to know if $2,000 is the right level of payment, for example. But I support the idea of that. We do need to provide much more direct relief to individuals and households, money in people's pockets. It should be retroactive, and the end of it should not be set at some arbitrary date. It should be pegged to some indicators, like the unemployment rate that we want to see. So I'm open to the idea of pegging it to a timeline after the pandemic ends. Again, I'm not sure that's the right indicator. But the idea of this, yes, I support 100%. History shows us that the best way that we can come out of economic crisis like this is with government spending, direct money to people, investments that are going to help people pay the bills, help people get back to work, help get our economy back on its feet. That's what we've got to do.
Okay. Let me move on to another topic. Do you support what has come to be known as defunding the police?
No, and I don't like the term defunding the police because I think different people mean different things by it. What I support is real investment in public safety. I don't think we should be spending less on public safety. I think we should be spending more on public safety. But what the current demonstrations and conversation around racial justice, which by the way is long, long, long overdue in this country, is reminding us is that we have to be thoughtful about what public safety means. Because right now, a lot of people are not safe in their communities. And so I want a fully funded police force. I want the police force to focus on crime. That's what they are good at. That's what they are trained to do. And we should have them do that. We should not have them responding to mental health emergencies. We should not have them trying to solve the problems of domestic violence or homelessness or substance abuse. We've got lots of people and organizations in our communities who know how to deal with those challenges, and we've got to support those professionals and those organizations and fund those programs. We need to let the police do the job of the police. And we need police reform because we have seen systematic problems in the way law enforcement is applied across people and across communities. And that's why I have on my website an agenda of police reform items, including a national use of force policy and demilitarizing the police, getting rid of surplus military equipment. I'm sorry, but no police department needs a tank. And that combination of things will help us build communities that are truly safe for everybody. That's what I support.
Let me move on to another one. You have been an advocate of a single-payer Medicare for all type healthcare system. Joe Biden doesn't support that. He argued strongly against it in the primaries. So if you could be brief on this one, I have a follow-up question. But first of all, if you were elected, would you be strongly advocating for Medicare for all? Would that be one of your agenda items to try to push?
I would be advocating for it. I think it is important to point out that the program that Joe Biden was talking about in his primary is not the version of Medicare for All that I support. It's the version that Bernie Sanders advocates. And there are some really important differences. I don't support getting rid of private insurance, for example. I also support a gradual phase in to Medicare for All. I've talked many times about what that transition looks like. And the first couple stages of the transition are the things that Joe Biden is advocating for, offering a public buy-in for anybody who wants to participate in Medicare and lowering the age of eligibility. So there's a lot of common ground between what Joe Biden is advocating and what I'm advocating. And I will continue pushing until every single person in this country has both health insurance and health care.
You anticipated my follow-up. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dana Balter. She's looking to unseat Republican Congressman John Katko in the 24th District this November. Dana is running as a Democrat. So we were talking about different policy areas briefly, and I have another huge one I want to ask you about. But again, if you could be brief, it would help. What specific environmental policy changes would you want to see in year one of a Biden administration? What would you want to be putting on the front burner right out of the gate?
Well, I think in the first year, I'd like to see us getting back into the Paris Accord and resuming some global leadership on this issue. I'd like to see the reinstatement of all the protections that Donald Trump and John Katko and the Republican Party have rolled back and eliminated over the last several years to get us back to where we were a few years ago. And I would like to work on the carbon fee and dividend, which is a bipartisan market-based solution to putting price on carbon pollution. It's been advanced by conservative think tanks. It has support from all parts of the political spectrum. And the science tells us that it's the single best thing we could do tomorrow to have a significant impact on global warming.
And if a coal plant was willing to pay that carbon tax or whatever we want to call it, Would you be okay with that, or would you be wanting to see more concerted effort to eliminate coal-generated electricity?
Yeah, I absolutely support moving to renewable energy. I think that is that has to be our ultimate goal. We have to get off of fossil fuels, but that's not going to happen in year one, right? You specifically asked about year one, so I think this is where we start. The move off of fossil fuels and onto renewable energy is going to take a while.
Okay. So I want to give our listeners kind of a quick sense of where your position is, and I want to try to take a couple stabs at that. Let me ask this question. Who's the current member of Congress that you think policy-wise you're closest to? Someone that you could say, okay, I'm kind of like that.
It sort of depends on the policy area. I see similarities with a lot of different members of Congress. In the House, one of the people that I'm really looking forward to working with and that I have admired so much in her freshman tenure is Congresswoman Katie Porter. What I think is phenomenal about her, and I'd hope to follow her example, is how fierce she is in holding the powerful accountable and fighting on behalf of the everyday folks who don't have as much power. I think she's laying down a marker and demonstrating great strength as a champion for everyday folks. And I hope to follow her lead there.
Let me try a different person. I think arguably the most famous new member of Congress would be, on the Democratic side, would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. Are there policy positions of hers that you disagree with that you know she is to the left of you on, or maybe to the right?
Yes.
I don't know. But is there any major disagreement there?
Yes, she's one of the primary advocates of the Green New Deal, which is not a bill that I support. We talked a little bit about environmental policy, and I agree with the goals of the Green New Deal. We need big, sweeping, bold action. But I think that the Green New Deal has a lot of things in it that are tangentially related and make it harder to advance concrete steps for real solutions to the climate crisis. I'm much more interested in focusing on more narrow, actionable items that we could get done. And I agree with her pursuit of real change and real solutions. I don't agree with the proposal or the way that she's going about doing it. That's one example.
Okay. And then my final way of trying to get at this is you have, I think, criticized Congressman Katko for some of the people that he's brought into the district to help him fundraise on the Republican side. So I wanted to pose that question hypothetically to you. Are there Democrats who, if they said, hey, you know, I'd like to come in and help you do a fundraiser, you'd say, no, thanks. That's not the message I want to put forward in the and what I want to convey. Any people there that you could name?
Not that come to mind right now, but I have to say, I don't know all the Democrats yet. Right. There are a couple of things that I object to, and I try to be really consistent and hold myself to the same standards. I objected to John Katko bringing Congressman Devin Nunes to the district for a fundraiser, because Devin Nunes has been actively undermining democracy and participating in corrupt and potentially illegal activities in his role as a congressman in support of some of the more egregious things that Donald Trump has done. Were there somebody on the Democratic side of the aisle that I knew to be doing those things, I absolutely would not campaign with that person or ask them to come and help me campaign. I also objected to John Katko fundraising with Mike Pence. Obviously, you know what my problems are with the Trump-Pence agenda. But to me, the bigger issue is about access, right? And John Katko brings somebody to the district for a $1,000 a plate fundraiser. You know, he did this with Paul Ryan in the last race. They sort of snuck him in and out the back door of an event. So Nobody, except for people who could buy that ticket, got to see him or speak to him. The press did not get to talk to him. That's really a problem for me because I believe in open governance. So I had the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, do an event with me, which I was very grateful for. And I asked, when you come and do this event, will you also do a mini town hall with me where we can make the offer to voters across the district to submit questions and we'll record a video where we talk and you answer their questions? And he was willing to do that, right? That I think is really important, giving access to power to everyday folks. And I've been working really hard to make sure that the people who support me and are helping me flip this seat are accessible, especially when they're in leadership, are accessible to the people of our district. And that's not the way John Katko approaches this. And that's the basis of one of my primary objections to how he conducts this work.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Democratic congressional candidate Dana Balter. We've got about 5-6 minutes left, and I want to try to squeeze a few more questions in if I could. And now I want to shift to a couple questions about the campaign itself. And I did something very similar with Congressman Katko last week, and I wanted to do the same thing with you. And it has to do with the campaign messaging. That's always a big concern of mine. And so let me ask you a couple questions about that. The first one is, and I'm going to start with his messaging of you and then your messaging of him. So the Katko campaign has put a lot of focus on your position regarding the Medicare for All plan and its impact on taxes. And taxes on the middle class. So can you explain here for our listeners how, briefly again if you could, how you'd finance this plan and how it would affect new taxes in the middle class?
Yeah, so I think first it's really important to say clearly that, not surprisingly, John Katko is misrepresenting my positions. He's been doing that for years. He's taken it to a new level now. We've already discussed where my position overlaps with Joe Biden, who has not actually criticized my plan. And all of that is misrepresentation by the congressman. I think it is really important to understand that we are already spending this money on healthcare. We are not talking about spending new money. What we're talking about is shifting where that money comes from, who is paying the bill. And under the Medicare for All plan that I support, 95% of households will spend less out of pocket on healthcare. Okay, right now we pay for healthcare through taxes, we pay for it through premiums, we pay for it through deductibles and through copays.
So if you add it all up, what you're claiming is you add it all up, 95% are going to end up better off.
Yes, only the top 5% of the economic ladder will be paying more. And I personally am okay with that. I think that is a reasonable trade-off. Okay. 95% of households spend less. And we will actually get health care to everybody, which is far from the current circumstance.
Okay. Let me flip it around. And again, I want to be mindful of the time here. But now in your messaging, you have claimed, and this is not something we've talked about yet, that I think this is right, that Congressman Katko has either voted or taken some specific action against lowering prescription drug costs. Could you explain the basis of that? And then I've got
Absolutely.
Another question for you.
So this year, the House passed H.R. 3, which is a bill designed to lower the cost of prescription drugs. It's a fantastic piece of legislation that has a number of components. The most important things that it does, it requires Medicare to negotiate drug prices and makes those prices available to people who have private insurance. We know that makes a huge difference. The VA does that already, and they save 40% on drug costs. This would make those savings available to everybody. This bill also pegs our drug prices to prices in other countries, right? We've all heard the stories where somebody pays $3,000 for medication here that they can go to Canada and get for $30. That should not be allowed to happen. We should not let pharmaceutical companies price gouge Americans. This bill pegs drug prices to our peer countries. And I believe it's a limit of 120%, it might be 130% of what the cost is in those other countries. Those are two of the main provisions. They're not the only provisions. But
well, let me jump in if I could, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to pose a question that comes right out of this that I think gets at the heart of what members of Congress have to do. So I want to get this in just in the last minute and a half here. So I understand what you're saying. And as you said, there were many different provisions of this bill. So members of Congress are always weighing this. You know, I like this piece. I don't like that piece. Am I willing to support this, even though it's got something I don't like, or this is why I'm going to vote no? I want to put a hypothetical to you, and I'm sorry to do that, but let's move you back in time, not forward in time. Let's put you in Congress in 2009, okay? Obamacare is up for a vote. Now, as you know, part of the deal struck to get the support behind Obamacare was to leave the drug pricing piece out. You know, Medicare was not going to be able to bargain for drug prices the way Medicaid does, or the example that you used. So you're in Congress 2009. You've got this bill. It expands coverage for people. It's got things that will try to lower costs, but it doesn't do anything about the prescription drug costs. Are you going to vote for that?
I'm not sure, right? It's, as you said, it's very hard to know in a hypothetical. I think that what I would have done was fought as hard as I could during the negotiation process to have drug prices addressed. If we couldn't make that happen, I think there's no such thing as a perfect bill, and I'd rather see 50% of what we want than 0% of what we want. So I probably would have supported it in the end. But that's not what we're talking about here. And what the congressman has raised as a primary objection to this bill is the idea that it stifles innovation. And that's simply not true. In fact, one of the provisions of the bill is investing the money that is saved on these negotiated drug prices into research and development of new medications.
So, and I hate to do this, but we've got to leave it there because we're already over time. But I appreciate that answer. That was Dana Balter. Again, she's the Democrat challenging incumbent Congressman John Katko in the 24th District this November. Dana, thanks again for making the time to talk to me. And I want to wish good health to you throughout the campaign.
Thank you so much. And same to you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.